Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is Side 1 of For the Record program number 466, an interview with Mark Ortiz. This is being recorded on June 27th of the year 2004. Veteran listeners to the broadcast that I've done over the years have heard either the entire or excerpts of Miscellaneous Archive Show M11, Uncle Sam on the Swastika, U.S. Industrial Cooperation with Nazi Germany. On that broadcast, I was joined by my co-host and co-worker, Mark Ortiz, who is my guest in on this broadcast. Now, Mark and I had not spoken. We'd lost contact for many years. And recently, we got back in contact. Mark came across my name. And Mark is going to be running for Congress, running for the Democratic nomination for the 8th Congressional District of North Carolina. Mark, welcome back once again to our airways.
Hello, and thanks for having me.
Now, you are an office seeker.
Yes, indeed. I am running in the Democratic primary, as you mentioned, for the 8th Congressional District in North Carolina. I face one opponent in the primary, which is July 20th. The incumbent is a millionaire Republican named Robin Hayes, who advertises a military trade show on his website. He has been in office since 1996. Despite the fact that the district is over 50% Democratic by registration versus only about 37% Republican by registration.
So basically it would indicate that at least from an electoral demographic standpoint, there would be the possibility of him being unseated in theory.
You would think so. In fact, he should be quite vulnerable this year, particularly if the election goes well nationally for the Democrats and there is a coattail effect.
Well, we will see. We're going to talk about what may be in store during the elections. In fact, that's one of the major focal points of this interview. Briefly, Mark, because I want to kick in some things by way of a hard introduction to the substantive discussion, give us a synoptic overview of the principal elements of your candidacy.
I am emphasizing four key issues. First, a real investigation of the September 11th incident. Now, you and I have discussed it, and we have some differences concerning it, but we are definitely in agreement that there's a cover-up here and that there needs to be a real, honest investigation of what happened on that day. And I decided to run because there is no other candidate out there that I am aware of nationwide that is making a priority of this issue or even raising it. Even Cynthia McKinney, on her website, last I checked, isn't saying a thing about 9/11, despite the fact that there's the Michael Moore movie out there, there's a 9/11 truth movement, there's the lawsuit by Ellen Mariani and others suing the president, there was a 9/11 truth candidate for the Republican nomination in New Hampshire.
By the way, that was a fellow named John Buchanan. He was the author of an article from the New Hampshire Gazette talking about the Bush family's investments in Nazi Germany, and most importantly, to my way of thinking, in late October of last year, he was the author of an article that I accessed in For the Record 435, indicating that Prescott Bush Sr. was not only involved with this Nazi American industrial complex, some of the same things we focused on way, way back in Uncle Sam and the Swastika, and that I've talked about many times since, but that he was involved in these things from he was involved with these corporations in a period from 1945 to 1951 when they were moving Nazi money abroad. And that, of course, was the focal point of the Bormann Flight Capital Program and the interdiction effort under Operation Safe Haven. So, yes, he ran. And, by the way, in connection with lawsuits, too, we should remember that in addition to the Ellen Mariani suit, there is a lawsuit by the survivors of victims of September 11th to the tune of some $1 billion, and that's being filed against a whole bunch of different people, ranging from members of the Saudi royal family, some of those have been dismissed, to people from the Bank Altaqua, one of the major focal points of my own research, and others. So,
point is, this is a huge issue, and no candidate for office, to my knowledge, with the only exception of myself, is even talking about it.
And
somebody had to do this.
Yep.
Somebody had to do this. Okay, that's the first issue I'm emphasizing in the campaign.
Mm-hmm.
Second, electronic election theft. Right now, we are on the verge of a new era in which votes are counted invisibly inside computers, and you can't even tell if the election is rigged. America has a long-standing tradition of rigged elections. It's been a long-standing problem in this country's history, going back to John Quincy Adams. But until recently, in order to manipulate a vote count, you had to do something somebody could see. Coerce somebody, stuff a ballot box, change ballots. You had to do something that was visible. But with electronic vote counting inside a black box, you cannot see what's going on. You cannot do a recount. And it is therefore possible for an election to be undetectably rigged, and people don't even know whether it's rigged and cannot prove whether it's rigged, which in the prevailing political and historical context virtually guarantees that it will be rigged. And if that is not halted, all peaceable political discourse becomes moot because you don't have real elections anymore. So that's the second point. Third point, we should keep our troops and our jobs at home. The big issue that my opponent in the primary is raising is job loss. Right now, my district has 3 times the national unemployment rate because the mill here in Kannapolis recently closed in bankruptcy, and it was formerly owned and sold about a decade ago by the incumbent candidate.
Hmm. Of course, here in California, you're not running in California, but not just in California, but nationwide, the whole issue of job loss and globalization is on the front burner. And a lot of jobs, particularly this broadcast originates in the Silicon Valley, and a great many jobs have gone overseas recently. So this is certainly an issue not unfamiliar to members of the listening audience. How about your fourth point, Mark?
Fourth point, preserve the Bill of Rights.
Oh, don't be old-fashioned, Mark. How quaint. Preserve the Bill of Rights. You know, I bet you're one of those loonies who favors separation of church and state, too.
Yes, as a matter of fact, my brochure explicitly states that, and favor a few other heretical ideas like gay rights and freedom of speech.
You are an antiquarian. Obviously, I'm exercising a little humor here. Mark,
right.
What I'd like to do to kick off a substantive discussion.
I want paper ballots too. That's really antiquarian.
Well, we will see exactly what takes place, because I'm personally, just from where I'm at, I am scared bleepless about the coming elections, because the party in power has committed a great many serious crimes, ranging from their manipulation of energy markets, and although there are some points of disagreement between you and I on September 11th, there certainly was a very powerful domestic component involved in that very broad international and complex incident, and the elements in and associated with this administration are complicit in some aspects of September 11th. And one of the things that scares the bleep out of me is that I don't think that they want to face the investigative processes that they would face if they get turned out of office. And I'm worried about what they might do in order to see to it that they are not turned out of office. What I'd like to do, Mark, is to sound a theme for this discussion, and it certainly is a political theme that has profound resonance with the substance of the Bush administration. What I'm going to do is read a couple of excerpts from the book American Dynasty by Kevin Phillips, a conservative, by the way, who's written a devastating book about the Bushes, the both Georges Bush. Again, American Dynasty, subtitled Aristocracy, Fortune, and the Politics of Deceit in the House of Bush. And the afterword to this book is called Machiavelli and the American Dynastic Moment. And it reads, "The political thinker Niccolo Machiavelli, 1469 to 1527, long a believer in the famous Florentine Republic of the Renaissance, began to lose faith in his later years as the tides of imperial power and ambition, French, German, and Spanish, swept across the Italian peninsula, washing away the old republican politics of city-states like Florence and Siena, too small to survive on their own. Unlike Machiavelli's less well-known books, which embraced republican politics and institutions, his most famous volume, The Prince, was dedicated to Lorenzo de' Medici, the Duke of Urbino. It encapsulated the techniques from amorality and fraud to religion by which the ascendant princely rulers might govern most successfully. As the 2004 presidential election took shape, another such Machiavellian moment was at hand. U.S. President George W. Bush, while hardly a Medici, was a dynast whose family heritage included secrecy and calculated deception. Hearkening to the increasingly imperial self-perception of the United States, the president's theorists and tacticians boasted of taking the advice of Machiavelli and the Chinese strategist Sun Tzu. The late Lee Atwater, chief political advisor to the elder Bush, and Karl Rove, strategist for the younger Bush, friends and collaborators, were both devotees of Machiavelli and the prince. Hardly a coincidence. And still later, he notes, Kevin Phillips, that is, in the book American Dynasty. The formal part of the text ends as follows. The possibility that the United States could edge toward its own Machiavellian moment in an early 21st century milieu of terrorism, neo-imperialism, and dynasticization is not far-fetched. As we have seen, Rove, the Bush dynasty's own political plotter, has been an avid reader of Machiavelli. While the analysis in the discourses upholds republicanism, the advice Machiavelli gives in The Prince was dedicated to the Medicis and designed to work in the new, princely, aristocratic, and neo-imperial milieu of 16th century Italy. Chapter 4, in its discussion of Bush domestic policy and compassionate conservative, unquote, rhetoric, has already referred to Machiavelli's advice that the prince should lie, but must, quote, be able to disguise this character well and to be a great feigner and dissembler, unquote. Moreover, again quoting, to see and hear him, he, the prince, should seem to be all mercy, faith, integrity, humanity, and religion. And nothing is more necessary than to seem to have this last quality. Everybody sees what you appear to be, few feel what you are, unquote. Other advice dwells on the merits of fraud, hypocrisy, faithlessness, and related practices, and 20th century academicians have noted Machiavelli's appeal to leaders like Hitler, Stalin, and Mussolini. Doubtless there are also hundreds of copies of The Prince at the CIA, which makes it revealing and arguably ill-advised that the two political advisors to the two Bush presidents should claim it as a Bible of sorts. Even in religion, Machiavelli's advice to emphasize it is relevant to early 21st century United States. His career in Florence overlapped that of Friar Girolamo Savonarola, the religious despot who ruled the gasping republic from 1494 to 1498, with a politics of fighting sin and immorality. Doubtless the youthful Machiavelli observed how close Savonarola came to achieving a theocracy even in republican Florence. Not a few Americans see a little bit of Savonarola in George W. Bush. The advent of a Machiavelli-inclined dynasty in what may be a Machiavellian moment for the American Republic is not a happy coincidence, but one that demands attention. Luckily, the arrival of a U.S. presidential election every fourth year typically brings with it an uncommon intensity of national debate, so perhaps attention will be paid. Since the events and upheavals of 2000-2001, the United States has had an abundance of unfolding transformations to discuss in economics, national security, and even religion. Of these, many can be considered and managed separately, but one is pervasive enough to make its impact felt almost everywhere: the extent to which national governance has, at least temporarily, moved away from the proven tradition of a leader chosen democratically by a majority or plurality of the electorate, to the succession of a dynastic heir whose unfortunate inheritance is privileged, covert, and globally embroiling. That, again, from conservative Kevin Phillips' book, American Dynasty, and that's how the main part of the text ends. Well, first of all, Mark, I don't want to, you know, to put words in your mouth. Is there anything
that... nasty, you'll probably dynasty.
What say?
If you live nasty, you'll probably die nasty.
Yeah, indeed. Well, we'll see exactly who winds up dying, how soon, and in what subjective emotional state. Is there anything in that those passages that I read with which you disagree?
Well, it certainly sounds like what we're seeing now, and after all, with the what you're seeing in the decline of republicanism and the rise of imperial monarchism is, as Hitler would put it, the triumph of the aristocratic principle over the democratic principle. And that, I think, is really what we're seeing. We're seeing the enthronement of corporations, which are run fundamentally on the aristocratic principle, and that is what's taking over the world. And it shouldn't be too surprising if electoral democracy is under threat with something like that going on.
Looking ahead, obviously we're in an election year. You're running for the Democratic nomination for the 8th Congressional District of North Carolina. Machiavelli appears to be the caller of the tune to which the Bush family dances. How would you look at the coming election and what might take place from a Machiavellian standpoint and bearing in mind the key planks of your platform?
Well, first of all, 30% approximately of the vote appears likely to be counted electronically with no paper trail. It's up from 15 to 20% last time around. So this is something that's coming in by degrees because, after all, the machines are expensive. And nowadays, as you certainly are aware in California, some of them are being decertified and thrown out. So it's uncertain how fast electronic voting will come, but there is still time to save real elections. Nevertheless, you can count on as big an effort as we've ever seen to assure the desired vote count by any means possible. So that certainly ties into my second issue. I think right now, as the conditions in Iraq continue to deteriorate and Bush's poll numbers continue to sag, I think that trend is likely to continue, which would mean a Kerry victory, a considerable coattail effect, and possible return of the control of Congress to the Democrats. Now, that's if we simply extrapolate existing trends. There is a big chance that something will happen or be arranged to happen before the election to do what September 11th did for Bush: boost his poll numbers, allow the passage of repressive legislation. They haven't been able to get Patriot 2 through Congress. If there's another September 11th, chances are they will be able to. That could even result in the suspension of the election if the polls don't look good for Bush.
Let's talk about the suspension of the election later on in the program, because that's something that has been kicked around. I also want to interject an element of my own rumination that falls in that gray area between paranoia and reality, and it's something that a lot of people haven't thought about. And frankly, if that comes to pass, I might not be around to provide follow-up commentary. But let's save that for later on in the broadcast, and let's start. All right, you're Machiavelli, but you're in the 21st century. Bush is your man. You've got electronic voting coming in power. One of the manufacturers of some of the electronic voting machines is the Diebold Company, and some of their machines in Southern California came under scrutiny and were found to be lacking in the recent referendum elections in the March of this past year in California. What can you tell us about
the first time?
No, it is not. What can you tell us about Diebold? Give us a history as best you're aware of the Diebold machines. Tell us about who's in charge of that company and some of the fears that have been engendered about that.
Well, the Diebold Company is the largest manufacturer of touchscreen voting machines. They are also, you've probably seen their name at the bank They make ATM machines. They make electronic cash registers, checkout machines at the grocery stores, all sorts of machines like that. And I believe they are also involved in electronic gaming machines, which is very interesting. And the number two supplier, Sequoia, definitely is involved in electronic gaming machines.
The number two supplier of electronic voting machines.
Yes, is heavily involved in the production of electronic gaming machines.
Let's hold Sequoia in abeyance for the time being. Tell us about.
Diebold is headquartered in Ohio, and its chairman of the board and CEO is named Wally Odell, actually Walden Odell, and he lives in Columbus.
Columbus, okay.
They have misspoken, I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. Anyway, he lives on the north side of Columbus in a really staunch Republican enclave, despite the fact that the middle of Ohio as a whole is predominantly Democratic. He is the one who has become infamous for his much publicized promise to deliver the election for the Republicans, which has been assumed to mean that he's going to do it through election rigging. Of course, he denies that. He merely means that he's going to contribute a lot to their campaigns. But the point here that I would make is that the CEO of this company is by no means politically neutral. He's a staunch Republican activist, and would like to, by legal or illegal means, your guess or mine, he would like to deliver this election and subsequent ones, no doubt, for the Republicans.
Is there now? There has been a history of the Diebold machines. They haven't been around for that long, but a number of questions have been raised about their role in past elections. I wonder if you'd tell us about that.
There have been a number, including one in Indiana, where grossly anomalous vote counts have occurred. Vote counts where the total votes were dramatically in excess of the total of people who showed up at the polls. And there's another situation in Florida, in Volusia County, where the machines were actually recording negative votes. We had, in this case, Al Gore's vote total going down as the election proceeded. So there are gross anomalies. There was also a big snafu in the 2002 elections in Georgia, where large numbers of Diebold employees were claiming irregularities, and the vote count was grossly at odds with exit polls.
Now, one of the things
in favor of the Republicans.
One of the things that was significant about that election, that is a very popular incumbent senator, Max Cleland, a Vietnam veteran who lost three limbs in combat, was voted out of office, and a number of people have raised questions about that. So the Diebold machines.
And he was charged with being soft on defense.
Well, he only has one limb left to sock away with, you know. I can believe that, you know. But at, all kidding aside, and by the way, Mr. Cleland is someone for whom I have great respect. His election was one of the things, or his defeat, I should say, was one of the things that led people to begin sniffing the air about the Diebold machines. I know that another of the people who was involved, I'm not sure if the machines were actually Diebold, but in Nebraska, Senator, was it Chuck Hagel?
Yeah, that's the other company. That's Sequoia, or this company, especially Sequoia, but Diebold too, I guess, operates under various names. They're not single companies. They have all kinds of different dummy companies and they market the election systems that they make under different names. It's like the company I used to work for in Silicon Valley that made wheel balancers and sent them out the door in four different colors with four different brand names on them.
Now, Hagel won, but he would, as I recall, the election was seen as being extremely close, and he won in a landslide. Am I correct in that regard?
Yes, and he was connected with election services and software. He was a principal of it.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a Daniel Hopsicker video called The Big Fix 2002 available from Hopsicker at www.madcowprod.com. That's his film company, Mad Cow Productions. However, if you type in the full Mad Cow Productions, you get a different business.
So it's www.madcowprod.
CowProd, think CowProd.
Yep. dot com.
Dot com.
Of course, Hopsicker, and perhaps I'll have a chance to touch on this in the second side of the program. Daniel Hopsicker is a name familiar to diligent listeners to the program, who has also done research on September 11th, and I've accessed some of his material in past discussions about Muhammad Atta and Associates in South.
There's a great video. You can actually buy the video I just cited, three additional ones, and Hopsicker's video on Muhammad Atta, which is called Muhammad Atta and the Venice Flying Circus.
Correct.
They have a package price for the five.
All right, we can't give the price on the air.
Oh,
but
oh, sure. I'm just saying you can order the bunch and save some money. If you go to the website, you'll see all that.
All righty, and we should mention that neither Mark nor myself has any business connections with Mr. Hopsicker, so we're
correct.
Not involved in any kind of commercial promotion here. Mark, we're almost out of time on this side. Now, you are running for Congress again in the 8th Congressional District of North Carolina.
Correct.
On a platform that, among other things, is advocating a full-scale investigation of September 11th, something no federal candidate that we are aware of is advocating. You are also very much concerned with electronic voting. Now, people who are interested in finding out more about your candidacy can contact you where and how?
By email, by going to my website, recently up, or by telephone. The website is http://markortizforcongress. That's MARKORTIZ. For Congress, all one word, no dots, no spaces, .org. That's the website. Email is Mark Ortiz, all one word, again, MARKORTIZ, the name is Spanish, at vnet.net. That's V as in Victor, net.net.
And by the way, in the description for this program, which will be up on the Spitfire website within a couple of weeks, there will be a link to Mark's website for people doing it. Is there a phone contact or any other information?
There is a phone contact, 704-933-8876, which can also be expressed 933-TURN. It's the phone number also for my chassis consulting business.
All righty. 704-933-8876 is the phone number. We've been visiting with Mark Ortiz, a candidate for the Democratic nomination for the 8th Congressional District of North Carolina, and also, not incidentally, my co-host almost a quarter of a century ago. Seems like a long time ago, doesn't it, Mark? It was almost 25 years ago that we did.
It doesn't.
Well, it was 24 years ago last month that we did Uncle Sam and the Swastika when we were guest hosting on Mom O'Shea's show on KPFA. So my former co-host on Uncle Sam and the Swastika is another of the identities, past identities worn by Mark Ortiz. We'll be visiting with Mark again in Side 2 of this program. This concludes Side 1 of For the Record program number 466, Interview with Mark Ortiz. For Mark Ortiz, my name is Dave Emery, saying thanks for listening.